So let's roll forward. We're a bit picking up from last week. We started looking at the teaching, the core teaching, the list known as the five aggregates. I don't like the translation aggregates. It's a really dull, literalish translation of the word khanda in Pali or skanda in Sanskrit. It literally means heaps or piles or collections of things. Five types of stuff, essentially. And so this is the stuff that Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara is meditating on at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, sees that these are all empty and is relieved of suffering. This is also the teaching that the Buddha gives as the first instruction in the definition of dukkha and the definition of the unsatisfactory to his friends in the very first teaching, the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma. In that very first teaching, the Buddha says, you know, dukkha, unpleasantness, pain, is all these things, you know, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, losing something that you love is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering, getting something you didn't want is suffering. In short, the five aggregates or khanda affected by clinging. There's challenges with that translation too, but these things are suffering. So the five clinging aggregates or the clinging aspects of experience. So these five are form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. Different translations for those. I like affect for feeling sometimes. Formations is really abstract, but it's sankhara. It's volition, it's story, it's narrative. So we gave a little overview of these last week. And how these are both the initial formulation the Buddha uses to teach how clinging leads to suffering, and it's the thing that Avalokiteshvara is meditating on at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, giving rise to freedom by seeing that these are all empty. So these two things are really in parallel with each other. So one of the things we hinted at, and I want to flesh out a little more now, is that this list, I often just call them aspects of experience. I don't really care that they're heaps. Sure, they're heaps. There is actually a beautiful old kind of like a metaphor in a way where they are, the word khanda, I'll use the Pali, the khanda are heaps partly because that's a common word that was used for heaps of firewood or fuel. So they're fuel for the fire. And the heat of fire is craving. The burning is clinging. The Buddha lays this out as the metaphor in many places. And so these five things are the fuel, right? This is what's burning. And so form is bodies and things that we see, other bodies and objects, where there's this natural reactivity that we have to sensory contact with things, where there's liking and disliking, right? Super basic. Vedana, feeling tone comes in when we make sensory contact with anything. Vedana says that something is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And so that pleasantness, unpleasantness, this is the second of the aggregates, Vedana, feeling tone. I like affect for this, just pleasant, unpleasant. That this almost immediate, like so immediate that it's hard to tease them apart, part of perception, that sensory contact hits our animal bodies already with a kind of charge, right? Because we're animals that want to survive. We love survival and reproduction and food and the usual things that animals love. And we want to stay alive. And so we have these nervous systems that are just devoted to staying away from pain and moving toward pleasure. And so everything, you know, the beautiful flower, the repulsive smell of excrement, the delighting image of the body type of the person you want to mate with, maybe, right? Like your type, the look of the person who might be your enemy or your friend. Like all of these things are profoundly survival based in our animal body. And so then we have this system that the Buddha recognizes that there's sensory contact through any of the physical senses, and an immediate reactivity that interprets them maps them as pleasant, unpleasant. And then what we can do is you can use this list of the khanda, the aspects, to understand that there's a sequential cognitive process that unfolds. So each of these things can be fuel for craving, you know, and together they create this experience of distress. So you can start, you can take them in a linear order, right? You start with form. This is a way of talking about sensory experience. Sensory experience makes contact, right? And I'll just ping here that we're essentially walking through dependent origination. We talked about this a tiny bit last week. There are some questions in the Facebook chat about dependent origination, and I'll get on to, we'll do it in depth over the next several weeks. So I'm just going to hint at it here. From the senses, there's sensory contact. From contact, there's vedana, feeling. This is the second of the khanda. And then the third is perception or recognition. So the mind or the cognitive faculties, this is really mind, heart, the interpretive framework begins to come in. And it comes in as we recognize things. So there's sensory contact, there's pleasant, unpleasant, and then there's the names of things. You know, like I see your faces and I know who you are. I'm like, oh, there's you, my friend, and there's you, my other friend. And, you know, or I look around my room and of course I know what all these things are, right? I'm surrounded by things that I recognize. And you know what it's like when a thing appears in your sensory field and you don't recognize it, the mind kind of goes like, what? What is that? You know, if you see a strange shape at night outside and your mind kind of goes, is it a person? Is it an animal? Is it an object? There's a kind of like, what is it? Not being able to recognize things is activating for the nervous system because you don't know actually, you know, whether it's going to be pleasant or unpleasant, right? And not knowing is generally unpleasant for the nervous systems of beasts of prey, as we are not the strongest predator on the planet, although we figured ourselves out. Even though we were not the strongest or the fastest, we were smart and tricky, and we did very well. But we don't have the nervous system of a top of the food chain predator. We don't have nervous systems like tigers, you know, who have no natural predators. They are chill. We're not chill. We're anxious because, you know, the tigers can eat us. So there's these ways that we can recognize how does a nervous system learn to be in a world that's dangerous. And we have those nervous systems. And of course, our primary predator is each other, because humans are the most dangerous people to humans. So we've evolved then the very complex recognition system. How do you recognize your friends and your non-friends? And this gets deep and political and racial and all class and all these things that get to be at play. So from form and feeling, right, initial sensory contact and then affect interpretation, pleasant, unpleasant, then there's recognition. What is this? Who is this? Right? I'm mapping the world around me. And from that map comes the fourth of the khanda, which is sankhara. Sankhara's an almost untranslatable concept. It's a beautiful concept in the Buddha's teachings. And the Sanskrit is samskara. The Pali is sankhara. The sankhara, again, I'll stay mostly in the Pali. The sankhara are patterns of narrative and image. They are everything you might consider a kind of mental or mental-emotional construction. They're all based in conditions. So based in the conditions of sensory contact, feeling, and perception, we have this map of the world around us. We have to include ourselves in this map. There are some neuroscientists who actually think that the sense of self or self-awareness is just a natural byproduct of mapping the world around us, and that map becoming socially complex enough that we have to begin to include ourselves in that map. So if initially the map is just like, where's the trees and the water and the tigers and the rabbits and, you know, that you don't have to include yourself in a very complex way in that map. But if it's all of those things, plus this is my family, this is that family, this is this tribe, that's that tribe, this is this city, that's that nation, that's these people doing these things, these people doing these other things, that gets really complex socially, and we start to have to include ourselves in that map of the world in order to make sense of it. How's this person related to me? And so there are some ideas that self-consciousness actually comes from this kind of mapping quality. And I think mapping is a beautiful way to talk about what sankhara does. The translators get into a few complexities around sankhara, particularly in the way that it is largely about not just story and, you know, the sense of self, or even like mind states, but there's this key central quality really in like the story of who I am, which is volition, which is choice, agency. So this way that the map I have of where I am in the social world or in the ecosystem around me, that map and the choices that I make in relation to it are so intimately interwoven that they're virtually the same quality. And that quality is sankhara. So it gets talked about like, these are the karmic formations. Karmic is the Sanskrit version. It would be kamic in Pali. Kama is like actions charged with ethical force, ethical or unethical force, that have conditioned this present moment based on, you know, the past. Sankhara, so you get how the narrative that's governing my choices is really like, okay, think about it in terms of like, how do I move through the world moment to moment, right? I'm not just a kind of sensate animal being like, this form, I like it, go toward it. You know, I'm not, that's way too simple, right? That's the substratum, those first three khanda. Now with sankhara, and the fifth is sense consciousness, is really just knitting it all together into consciousness. But in sankhara, what I really have is this very complex sense of being a person with a past, with a life story, with a web of social relations, with a web of ancestral relations. You know, who are my people? Where did they come from? What do we do? You know, culture is a sankhara. Family is a sankhara. Like these kinds of stories. The way that I could say I know myself to be a, you know, think of any of the, you know, histories that you carry, like the ancestral histories that you carry. Say, oh, you know, like some of my people came from England and Puerto Rico to get to New York. So I could think about those as cultural threads. And some way that those show up in my life, okay, that's a sankhara. That's a kind of deep influence from the past, how it created the life that I'm in right now. It created this body. It created some of the cultural context for this. And it's creating the words that I'm speaking right now. It's creating the way that I think about myself. I'm this kind of person. So everything we think about ourselves and our families and our relations, out, self, family, you know, community, culture, world, ecosystem, universe, is conditioned by how we got here and the forces that shaped us, right? Both nature and nurture, how I was born and what I learned, where I grew. All of this is sankhara. And all of that is the causative force behind my choices, right? So notice, so take a moment, just try this out. Right where you are, drop for a moment just into a version of your meditative state, just where you're aware of the present. So you're aware of your body, your moods, you're listening to the talk, wherever you are, here you are. So you get a snapshot, like here I am in the present moment. And then see if you can feel how you have the power, agency, right, to do something in this next moment. Just right wherever you are. You could choose to do any number of things. You could move your body, you could get a snack, you could turn off the talk, you could go do something else, you could get really still, you could think about something. You could do any number of things in this moment. Can you feel, first of all, the presence of that choice, that you're free to do something in this moment, and that to sit here and listen, you know, keep doing what we're doing together, that's a choice. So you want to feel the choice. That's beautiful in itself to hook into. You can hook into that at any moment. But going further, can you feel how the choices that you maybe feel into, like the choice that you're likely to make, you know, or the choices that are like, you know, the things that you might really choose from, right? I might move my leg, there's a little ache in the hip. I'm probably going to keep talking with you for another few minutes. Like, you know, there's momentum from the past. There's who we are. You're the kind of person who's liable to do certain kinds of things and not other kinds of things. So then can we recognize that we both have choice, but also that the energy behind those choices is flowing through us or into us from the past? That all of these forces have come together to make our choices in this next moment not random. That's partly how we know that we are a somebody and not just an impersonal, you know, force of nature. And we'll get to that. Maybe you are, maybe we are. But the feeling is of being somebody, right? Like you have a choice, but that choice is conditioned. Right? I was raised to be polite, so I'm not going to say something like super rude in the next minute. I could, right? My kid has been teaching me all sorts of new ways to be rude, but I'm not going to do it. Right. You know, if you have a kid, right, you've learned, you're like, what is this bizarre internet reference you're coming up with? You've never even seen the internet. You know, it's like, oh, some kid on the playground said this completely ridiculous thing, and now you're singing it at full volume in the kitchen. I'm like, what is this? So I'm not going to repeat any of those, right? Because I was raised to do a certain thing, right? But, you know, these come in a privileged and traumatic formations, right? So there are some things that I could make a choice to do, but I don't know how to make that choice because, you know, because systemic oppression, because as a frail, mixed race, kind of queer intellectual kid, I wasn't taught to do certain things, right? Like whatever your positionality, whatever kind of body you have or social class you come from, you were taught certain things. And those lessons, whether they were, again, a privilege or trauma, right? Whether they were you know, oppressive lessons. You know, oh, you have this kind of body, don't take up space. Or, oh, you have this kind of body, you're going to be bad. Or you have this color skin, therefore you can do these things in life and not these other things, whatever it is. Those karmic forces constrain and shape the choice you can make in this next moment. And so part of what is possible and really beautiful with the inquiry into sankhara is there's the invitation to see the conditioned nature of those things, right? To see the relationship between karmic conditioning and choice. That's why they're called volitional formations. This is really like how we make choices. And I think a huge part of what is liberating, in when we say that the Buddha's path leads to liberation, what's it, what is liberation from what, or in relation to what? What is liberation? I think a huge part of this liberation is that when we know so deeply, really, like in deep in our beings, that conditions have led to this moment, and that those conditions have constrained our sense of what's possible, the choices we can make, that if we see that those are not laws of nature, that they're just conditioned arisings that could be different, I think the range of choice opens up vastly. Because suddenly, if there's something that's possible to do, I might just be able to do it. You know, if I can recognize that the forces that make me not able to do something are flimsy in a certain way. I think partly what the Buddha does is he sees through culture, and he sees through family and inheritance in a certain way. This is why, and this is a commercial for the study class that we're doing, come to class on Thursday and we'll read this text. I think this is why he sees through caste. Why he says, yeah, this is why the Brahmins are not particularly superior to, you know, the aristocrats or the merchants or the working class. Because the only thing that makes you noble or, you know, kind of worthy in a certain way is your actions. He says, actually, the thing that you have choice in is that you can harm or not harm in the next moment. And that's the heart of choice, is that we are powerful in a certain way and we can hurt others. And there's this tremendous and poignant responsibility with that. And so the Buddha's like, yeah, well, the thing that creates the best possible momentum for the future is to not hurt people. People meaning human people, animal people, spirit people, plant people, earth people, people, beings. To not cause harm is the center of the whole thing. Because what you are recognizing is how being asleep to the process of conditioning means that you're going to repeat the unhealthy patterns that have come from that conditioning, right? If you are asleep in a culture that has tried to teach you, you know, a misogynistic or racist or anti-Semitic or, you know, hateful ideology of any kind, if you don't deconstruct that, you will perpetuate it, right? Because you learned it, right? They told it to me, it must be true, unconsciously. Education, you know, is liberating because it actually tells you that things are conditioned. You know, if you were raised to be white and you're like, whiteness is natural, there's nothing, you know, it's natural that I feel good about myself and I was raised and I'm happy and I have a good white family. And then you learn that whiteness as a concept was invented in the late 17th century by Southern North American British descended aristocrats who were upset because the poor white working class was allying with the free black working class and the indigenous resistance to resist white upper class domination. And they said, this will not do. because of course there's always far more working class people than there are rich people, and they started passing laws that created a concept called whiteness. And they basically said, if you're white, you get more privilege than if you're not white. And so then they divided the white working class from the free black working class in the slave era in order to break apart the resistance to wealth. Side note, right? History of racism, there you go. But whiteness is conditioned. It's a completely conditioned cultural framework. And learning this, right? What does learning this do? Like, what happens when you learn a bit of history like that, right? You might, the goal hopefully is not to make you angry at rich British people, although that's justified, but is of the past, you know, or the present, but is to trouble, like stir up trouble in the waters of the assumed real, right? I was taught something kind of unconsciously. I assume it's true, and I haven't questioned that. But woven into that sankhara, right, is a conditioned story. Woven into that sankhara is layers of harm, right, for myself and others. And so then that harm is going to be perpetuated as long as that sankhara is unquestioned. And so then you do some historical deconstruction work, you work on whiteness or whatever, any part of history you look at, part of what we're learning is that the concepts we've inherited are, they're historical, they're not universal. And the Buddha was very, very clear on this. You know, and so, the power differential between a Brahmin and a working class person, you know, between these different castes, the Buddha said, you know, this is only based on convention. There's no fundamental difference of worth between a Brahmin and a Sudra, you know, or a Vesa, the two lower working class castes. And so in the aggregates, the khanda, I think what we're invited to do is use this sequence to understand how unconscious views and stories and patterns, you know, how they become implanted in the heart, how they develop and are reinforced moment to moment, right? When I see something and there's the automatic judgment of it as pleasant, and then there's a recognition of it as a thing that I like, and those things stitch together into a story, how easy it is for that then to pour forward into the volition, the choice, to move toward it, to grasp. I want that. And as we deconstruct this, we see that, you know, the story is based on all these forces from the past, some wholesome, some quite unwholesome, and that even in this moment, you can bring consciousness to this unfolding process where there's like pleasantness and you know, recognition. This is what happens in the meditative state. You get very, very slowed down, and you can actually begin to see how these different khanda, these different aspects of experience arise simultaneously, that or nearly simultaneously. The Theravada tradition would say successive mind moments. There's contact, and then there's a kind of the interpretation, pleasant, unpleasant, vedana. And then there's a kind of recognition, oh, this is what that is. And it coalesces into a story of wanting or fearing or reactivity in some way. And then that story, that initial grasping, then coalesces further into clinging. Oh, you know, this is who I am in relation to this, right? Subject and object appears with sankhara. That's the map that includes myself, right? Because if I really want to understand what's going on when I see something and I want it, I have to include myself in the story. And so suddenly, here's me, and my satisfaction depends on getting that. And so then all of this arising, you can tease it apart. You can say, oh, you know, this is what you do in dependent origination, just finishing up here, right? The sequence is contact, feeling, grasping, clinging. And so contact is sense contact, right? Feeling is vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Grasping is this kind of thirst that arises, right? So the aggregates is a way to really peel that apart, particularly to peel apart how we get from sensory contact through feeling to these like contracted states of clinging, of grasping and clinging. So pausing again here before we, just as we finish, and well, let's do it again, that little choice exercise. So come back to yourself, become present for a moment. Feel how you have choice. And that, and maybe this time, like, do something. Make a choice of what to do in the next moment. And whatever it is, it could be physical, it could be mental, you could just direct your attention somewhere. But do something on purpose. And then, you know, notice what that was, what it felt like. But also notice that it's almost like you could ask yourself, well, where did that choice come from? The thing that I did, where did that come from? And I might say, oh, it was just a natural response. Like, my hip is a little sore, so now I'm stretching out my leg. Okay, it's totally natural. This is great. I moved away from a painful sensation. Now it's a different sensation. But if I slow down into that, how I did that, I could write paragraphs on what just happened, right? I had to learn in meditation that it was okay to move, because for a while I was taught that you should not move and you should suffer through painful sensations. I did a lot of yoga and I learned some preferential movement pathways. So when I stretched out my leg, I actually did some very particular internal external rotation thingies that feel really good. And I learned that. And I'm right now pressing outward through my heel and I can feel the center of the three strands of the hamstring in a way that feels lovely. And, you know, like all of that, it's all learned, right? It's all learned. You know, even the way that now I'm in this posture where one leg is in and one leg is out, and I can actually kind of energetically flash on all these different times that I've been in this shape, right? And this shape has names in yoga. And there's, you know, like you can take anything apart, right? And a good writer, a good novelist, a good poet does this, right? Like, what is a good poem other than someone who was really awake to a moment and like, and then told you about it in an extraordinary way, you know? And I think that when we do this, there's a beautiful kind of liberation that happens, because you actually understand what power agency is giving you moment to moment, and how much more powerful that becomes when we know where we've come from, when we understand the past, we're not as bound by it. Last side note, this is why the Buddha remembers his past lives. I think this is what he's doing. It's he's unhooking from being driven by past karma, but driven by the past. You become conscious of it. Here's all the lives that I had before. And he says, oh yeah, I'm not bound by those. Therefore, I'm free to make any choice in this next moment, including the choice not to be reborn if I choose that. Because up until now, rebirth is unconscious and habitual, right? It's a habitual pattern. You didn't choose it, right? You were under the sway of the deep unconscious urges toward life of various kinds. And now you can choose. So, all right, pausing there.